He's making predictions. Last few verses, he was predicting in 2 days, day after tomorrow, Svayambhu Ramana is going to come and offer you his daughter, and that'll fulfill you've been meditating for 10,000 years in anxiety how you're going to find a wife. No problem, I arranged it. Day after tomorrow, your problems will be solved. That was the material benediction. But right after that, okay, now your material life is resolved. You've been with that material desire. You've been worshiping me for 10,000 years, so you also get spiritual perfection. So in the next verses, Lord Vishnu predicts Kardama's ultimate perfection. We can read verse 31, starting there. Kritva doyam cha jiveshu dhatva chavoyamat movan mayatmanam sahajagat drakshasyatmani chapimam. Showing compassion to all living entities, apimam. Showing compassion to all living entities, you will attain self-realization. Giving assurance of safety to all, you will perceive your own self as well as all the universes in me and myself in you. So the Lord mentions how Kardama, by virtue of his long practice of meditation, will achieve the perfect realization that everything is in the Supreme, and the Supreme is in everything. This is the Vedantic realization. Krishna teaches it in the Bhagavad Gita. Lord Gaurakshay Vishnu taught it to Brahma in the four-verse Bhagavatam. Basic perfection of yoga. This is real samadhi, to have this realization. But he only mentions that second. First, he mentions what he considers more important achievements on the part of Kardava. That two things. That he's merciful, compassionate to all living entities. And that he not only, I mean, it's one thing to have such good intentions, you know, to want to help everybody. But more than that, he's able to effectively actually give them fearlessness. It's one thing to want to help people, it's another thing to actually be able to do it. And to help them in such a way that they actually make spiritual progress. So the person who can, first of all, muster a feeling of compassion for others, that's a great accomplishment. And then to be able to practically do something to deliver people from material fear, this is more than the perfection of realizing that God is everywhere and everything is in God. What does it mean, this compassion on all living entities? Well, what's the value of this? How rare is it? So here we're seeing how Kardama is a perfect Vaishnav, but these are also, that's one way to look at it, the description of Kardama as a pure devotee, that he's also an exemplary Brahmana. Not every Brahmana is a devotee, a Vaishnav, but every pure Vaishnav is automatically a Brahmana. So compassion, daya jiveshu, this is certainly a necessary qualification for a Vaishnava. Prabhupada explains, to be a second class Vaishnava, you cannot be a second class Vaishnava, madhyama adhikari, unless you have compassion for the conditioned souls. You won't care to preach. You won't have any interest in preaching if you don't feel concern for other people's suffering. If you're only interested in your own salvation, then you won't bother to come to the second class platform. You'll remain a Kanishka Adhikari. So that's Baba's explanation. And on a more ordinary level, looking at the qualifications of a Brahmana or a Kshatriya, concern for the general population, for their welfare, this is what characterizes Brahmins and Kshatriyas. They want to selflessly advance the welfare of human society. Vaishyas are not interested in that. And when you have Vaishyas or Shudras running the government, then you have selfish, corrupt politicians, in effect. Then everything is corrupt. You have to have noble people. So both the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas share this noble quality of compassion. Only because they have such elevated consciousness and proper behavior, sadachara, are the Kshatriyas and Brahmins able to have any compassion. A person who is indulging in sinful activities cannot feel compassion, especially those who kill animals, who these four basic principles of sinful life. If you're killing animals, if you're taking intoxication, if you're gambling, if you're indulging in illicit sex, then you lose your sense of compassion, a feeling for anybody else. If you're killing the unborn child in your own semen or in the womb, to waste your semen is murder. So this pure Vaishnava, the Pukka Brahmins, traditionally, when a man passes away, they do the antyeshi, funeral ceremony, but part of that is a special ritual for brunhatya, the atonement for his having wasted semen during his life. It's killing living entities in the semen. What to speak of those who indulge in abortion and other abominations. We come from a culture where violence and abominable activities are just the way of life. So we come from a culture, therefore, that can't really feel compassion. It's only because we've been touched by the association of a pure devotee that we've been lifted up out of this selfishness. We should be very careful not to revert back to our selfish ways. If we feel any compassion, if we feel any urge to preach, it's only because pure devotee is injected at us, that in us. It's not our conditioned nature at all to feel any compassion for anybody. But that compassion is our ticket to pure devotional service. We're able to come to the functional platform of Madhyama Adhikaris because we can feel the urge to preach, to benefit others. Anyway, the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, each in their own way, are kritvadayam chajiveshu, trying to be merciful to the conditioned souls. Kshatriyas, we'll read in a few verses about how the Kshatriya works for the benefit of others. He's a protector. He defends the pious by subduing the wicked. That means he uses violence. He uses force to protect the citizens. That's his way of showing compassion. A Brahmin is trying to do the same thing, but he has a different methodology. A Brahmin doesn't deal in force. He deals in knowledge. He teaches, he studies, and he teaches. And by his teachings, he's giving fearlessness. Madhya Madhikari preaches. Prabhupada mentions also even the Uttamadhikari, because he knows the real position of fearlessness from direct realization. He's not just talking Shastra, but he sees Krishna face to face. The lotus feet of Krishna are directly realized experience for him. So he knows what purelessness is. So when the Uttamadhikari, when the Paramahamsa announces, yes, you know, we can all be fearless, that's the most convincing. But the Uttamadhikari empowers his disciples, the Madhyamadhikaris, to also pass on that message of fearlessness. So the Brahmins, whether they're Vaishnavas or some other class of Brahmins, in general, they're meant to elevate other human beings from animal life, from the fearlessness of forgetting their spiritual identity, the fearfulness. The fearful condition we're talking about is human beings living like animals, forgetting that they're servants of God, forgetting that they're human beings. So to deliver everybody from fearlessness, the Brahmins teach the truth according to their own realization. Paul makes the comment, the purport, compassion is required to properly use God's energy for one's real self-interest. The Vaishyas think they're smart. They're getting all, you know, collecting all the money. They think that they're working for the self-interest, and these foolish Brahmins are just sitting around begging. But they don't understand that just putting money in the bank is not really the the way you gain your true self-interest. The Brahmins and the Kshatriyas are actually working for their own self-interest and for that of others, because they have a broader vision. Anyway, without that, even somebody who's trying to practice devotional service remains a Kanishadhikari forever, until he develops dayab jiveshu, compassion for the conditioned souls. Ultimately, Prabhupada says the sphere that someone like Gautama delivers us from is the fear of dying in forgetfulness of God. Then in the second half of the verse, after mentioning the more important accomplishments that Gautama has achieved, there's cheers, plenty of cheers if you want. Take a chair to sit in here. Self-realized, Atmavan, Mayatmanam Sahajagat Drakshasi. You will see. Maybe you haven't achieved that ultimate perfection yet, but you, Kardama, are very quickly on the path toward quick perfection. And you will, if not already, you will see the whole world, including yourself, are all contained within me. How is that? It's not, according to the way it is in the Mayavadi misconception, that everything is one, that there are no distinctions. No, God, Prabhupada emphasizes, no, God is a separate person, everybody else is separate, but everybody and everything belongs to God. Everything is God's property. So in that sense, everything is in the Supreme Person. Everything is related to him and is meant to be used in his service. Kardama has, or very soon will fully realize that understanding. And then also the counterpart of that, you will also see me within yourself. God is everywhere. Everything is God's energy. But you can also find God in your own heart. There's a very intimate, personal connection there. Not that just God is the cosmic master, and he's so important, and he's so busy with everybody else, that you can't have an intimate relationship with him. No, he's sitting in your heart. He's waiting for you to turn your attention to him. You're too busy, not that he's too busy to talk, to deal with you. You're too busy to deal with him. And when you put aside all your material busyness, he's been sitting in your heart forever waiting for you. This analogy of the two birds in the tree. Dvau suparno sayuja sakayau. Two friends, two birds, who are sitting on the same tree, but one of them is busy trying to enjoy the fruits of the tree. And the other one is waiting for his friend to turn his attention back to him. This is actually from the Rig Veda. It's quoted, Prabhupada quotes it from the Mundaka Upanishad, but it also originally occurs in the Rig Veda itself, this verse. So the philosophy of the difference between the Jivatma and Paramatma is there in the Rig Veda. It's original Vedic philosophy. It's not something new. Not some medieval bhakti creation. It goes all the way back to the beginning of time. And that oneness of the two birds is their oneness of purpose. Manmana, Krishna teaches at the end of the Gita, Manmana bhava mad bhakto madhyaji imam namaskaru. Just be my devotee, worship me, think of me all the time, and submit to me. And then you'll come to me. Your life will become perfect. So, anyway, in this verse, Lord Vishnu is promising Karna, you may have a little further to go, but you're practically there. You've practically realized this perfection already. So, although he's sending Karna out to go get married, get entangled in family life, indulge in material sense gratification, but don't worry, because you're going to be coming to me very soon. Okay. One point being made here, Brahmins and Kshatriyas are compassion to the conditioned souls. There's one statement from the Shatapatha Brahmana again. We've quoted from it four or five times already. The Brahmana that explains the white Yajurveda, the Vajrasayani Samhita. 100 chapters of the Shatapatha Brahmana. In the sixth chapter is this statement. I don't have the Sanskrit. The Brahmins and the Kshatriyas enclose or envelop the Vaishyas and the Shudras. But this doesn't mean that they simply subjugate the Vaishyas and the Shudras. That's the caste system. But it means that they protect. The Vaishyas and the Shudras don't have the strength to maintain themselves without the protection of both the Kshatriyas and the Brahmins. The Kshatriyas give the physical support, the protection against violence of criminals and tyrants. And the Brahmins protect them from ignorance by giving them spiritual instruction and guidance and helping them engage in performing of sacrifice. Okay. Then we'll look at verse 32. Here, Lord Vishnu further predicts that the personality of Godhead is also going to take birth as a son of Kartava. Okay, now I promise you the liberation. That's not all. Before you get your liberation, you will have the pleasure of having the Supreme Person of me becoming your son. Lord Narayan is promising, I'm going to become your son also. That's verse 32.
Sahaham swam shakalaya twadvirena mahamune tavat shetre devahutyam praneshye tatvasanghitam. O great sage, I shall manifest my own plenary portion through your wife Devahuti, along with your nine daughters, and I shall instruct her in the system of philosophy that deals with the ultimate principles or categories. Okay, that's Swamsha Kalaya. So Prabhupada discusses in the purport this terminology, Swamsha Kalaya. Lord Kapiladev is a partial incarnation. He's Vishnu himself. But when we talk about amshas, the Lord's personal partial incarnations, that doesn't mean that they're less than God. But God is not showing his full personality. He's not showing all of his opulences, all of his glories. When he appears as Matsyadev or Varahadev, he's not displaying his personality as fully as he does when he appears as Krishna, Ramachandra, even Vamanadev. He's holding back a lot of his personality, not showing it. So similarly, Kapiladev is mostly showing a certain aspect of his personality. He's the ideal teacher. He's giving instruction. You don't see Kapiladev having Rasa Leela or killing demons. He's not displaying those pastimes. He's sitting down with his mother and giving her spiritual instruction in this philosophy that deals with the ultimate principles or categories, the Sankhya philosophy. Tattva Samhitam, the science of the elements, tattvas. Analysis of nature, of existence into its elements, material and spiritual elements. So that's what Kapiladev teaches. Okay. And Kardama is glorious because he's a perfect Brahman. Because he's worshipped the Lord successfully for 10,000 years. Now he's promised he's earned liberation by his sadhana, but also by his devotion. The Lord has agreed to become his son. So Kardama is glorified by that. And his wife Devahuti, he hasn't even met her yet. Yeah. I mean, who's Devahuti? He doesn't know. He never met her, this girl. He'll meet her in 2 days. But it's already predicted that she will be glorified as she will be also the mother of God. Okay, so we look at the next verse. Okay, that point is the end of Vishnu's address to Kardama. So are there any comments or questions at that point? Yeah. Yes, because the 25th and the 26th elements in Kapiladev's list are the Jivatma and the Paramatma. The atheistic Kapiladev doesn't identify the Jiva the same way as we do. In the atheistic system, there's a Purusha, but that Purusha is totally inactive. He doesn't do anything. He's conscious, but he has no activity. All activity in the atheistic Kapila system is performed by Prakriti alone. Prakriti is active, but not conscious. And the Purusha is conscious, but not active. And the two of them combine, and then there's material creation. But there's no God, and there's no Jiva as we know him. Because we understand the Jiva as a knower and a doer. He's a small knower. He only knows something, and he only does a few things, but he does have, in part, the powers of the Supreme Soul. You know, it's different. The atheistic system is a whole different system. And what people think is Sankhya philosophy is this atheistic system that was taught much later by somebody else who took the same name. Anyway, in the system of Kapila, the son of Devahuti, there are also those two spiritual elements. Okay. But that's, you know, without that, then the system is not much use. The whole idea is to realize yourself as spirit soul and realize the Supreme Spirit. Otherwise, what's the use of wasting your time analyzing material nature? It's only a stepping, it's a ladder leading up to understanding all this whole creation is very wonderful and perfectly designed. Where is the intelligence that designed it? So the understanding of the intelligent structure of the universe leads you to want to discover the intelligence and the person who has that intelligence. Okay, yeah. Okay, anything else? Then we look at verse 33 then. Maitra uvacha evam tam anubhashyat bhagavan pratyad akshajaha jagama bindu sarasat sarasvatya parishvitat. Maitreya went on. Thus having spoken to Kardama Muni, the Lord, who reveals himself only when the senses are in Krishna consciousness, departed from that lake called Bindu Sarovara, which was encircled by the river Saraswati. So, having promised all this, having congratulated Kardama and assuring him that his life is on the verge of perfection and he's going to enjoy so many benefits of his austerities, he disappears. According to Jiva Goswami, disappearance of Vishnu should not be considered a separate incarnation. He says, well, if you want to use, you know, also consider under the term incarnation, avatar, every time the Supreme Lord appears to anybody in a vision, okay, you can do that, but it's not the ordinary use of, it's not the way the words are usually used. That's Jiva Goswami's comment. If we go by the common, the conventional use of the word avatar, it's when the Lord actually descends to the earth. Either he has parents, or there's some way that he makes his appearance, and he stays here for some time, and he goes back. It's not just some momentary, or, you know, for a few minutes, appears to someone and then rushes back to Vaikuntha. That's not normally called an avatar. Okay, so this is not, according to the way the word avatar is usually used, this appearance of Lord Vishnu is not an avatar, it's just a personal realization, you know, a vision, audience granted to Kardama Muni. He's called Pratyad Akshaj. Yes, yeah. Was this appearance to Kardama predicted?
Yeah, like somewhere in some part of
Well, it's mentioned in the second, at least twice in the first cantos of the Bhagavatam. That's after the fact. I mean, that's just.
I want to do now to respond to me.
Okay. 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 I mean, it's not really a prediction because. Sutta Goswami, or rather Shukadeva, is speaking much, you know, 5,000 years ago, much after Kapila, but he does mention Jagye Chakardama Grihe Nanu Devahutyam, that the Lord appears as the son of Devahuti. Because this happened in Satyuga, I don't know what scriptures we have, you know, we can identify as going back to Satyuga that would mention. But it's mentioned in the Bhagavatam, other Puranas. Maybe somewhere in the Vedas there might be a mention of Kapila Muni, I'm not sure. There are too many avatars to announce them all. You know, Prabhupada mentions that Lord Vishnu appears in every single species of life. So, I mean, the Bhagavatam describes 30 or 40 incarnations at the most. And if there's one for every species, that means we're missing, you know, several million, 8 million incarnations that the Bhagavatam doesn't mention. So in the shastras that we have any access to, all the avatars can't, you know, even a fraction of the avatars can't be mentioned. Well, what you can take as a criterion if you want to, you know, you need shastric evidence to judge whether someone's a real avatar or not. You can learn from studying about the avatars who are described how an avatar is supposed to behave, what are the symptoms of an avatar. And thus, when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya met Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, although he was a Mayavadi, and he didn't want to accept that Lord Chaitanya was Krishna, he said, no, come on, there's no incarnation, there's no avatar in Kali Yuga. Vishnu is Tri Yuga. He doesn't appear in Kali Yuga. So he refused Gopinathacharya, who is actually, Gopinathacharya is also Vishnu Tattva. I forget which, he's a who? He's some, one of the amshas of Vishnu, Gopinathacharya. He's not even a jiva. And he was preaching to Sarvabhama Bhattacharya's uncle, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna. You have to accept that. He wouldn't, philosophically. But when he saw the ecstatic symptoms in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he knew that this is not an ordinary person. Yeah, and his mind started to change. So there are, you know, someone who really knows the Shastra, when he meets an avatar, he's going to say, wait, you know, I don't know about this one, and there isn't supposed to be any in Kali Yuga, but he's got all the symptoms of an avatar according to the way they're described in the Shastras. Someone's learned it, even if it's a Mayavadi, he'll have to, you know, recognize that something's going on there. So Vishnu talks to Karnama, which is something wonderful in itself, and then he promised to become his son. This is only possible because of Karnama's pure devotion. Atak Sri Krishna Nama Adi Nabhave Grayamindriyai. Material senses and material mind can't even begin to realize the personality of Godhead. What to speak of making him appear in front of you and agree to have a personal relationship with you. You can't even begin to realize the Lord in your heart, as the yogis try to, without with material senses in mind, you cannot. When your senses, when your tongue and other senses become disposed to serving the Lord, to engaging in devotional service, only then can you actually begin to realize him as a person. The Gyanis and the Yogis, Brahmavadis, they have some kind of realization, but not personal realization. They can realize the Lord's impersonal aspect, his perfection, his eternality, but they can't realize his personal glories. The yogis can have some realization of Paramatma, but they can't. That Paramatma is simply standing in their heart like the deity on the altar that we cannot understand. You know, we can see the deity, but we cannot fully realize that that's Krishna directly. We think a statue is standing there, not doing anything. So the yogis see the Supersoul, maybe, if they're advanced enough, but that Supersoul doesn't do anything. Now, the pastimes, the activities, personal reciprocations, loving reciprocations of the Lord with his devotees, that can only be realized when there's devotion. So Karnama is, not only is he already liberated, but obviously he's already a very advanced devotee of the Supreme Person. He has love of God. Yatatam api siddhanam kaschin mam vidhi tatvataha. Out of many thousands of men, one may strive for perfection. And out of many thousands of such persons who are trying to make spiritual advancement, just one might know me as I am in my personality. Okay. Anything? Then there's a couple, some description how I'll skip over the next two verses. Not just read the translations. While the sage stood looking on, the Lord left by the pathway leading to Vaikuntha, a path extolled by all great liberated souls. The sage stood listening as the hymns forming the basis of the Samaveda vibrated by the flapping wings of the Lord's carrier, Garuda. Then, after the departure of the Lord, the worshipable sage Karnama stayed on the bank of Bindu Sarovara, awaiting the time of which the Lord had spoken. So, what do you do? Well, Krishna's disappeared. He's got 2 days, so he just continues his meditation for another 2 days. just patiently waiting. Taptenu kampam susa mikshamana. This is the business of a Madhyama Adhikari. What's his primary responsibility? Is to be patient. Taptenu kampam susa mikshamana. Be confident, you've been promised the mercy of Krishna, but you have to wait a little while until you become fully qualified to take it. Like a young man, father has passed away, and he's got the estate promised to him, but he has to come to a certain age before he can receive his father's inheritance. So the Madhyamadhikari has to make further advancement before he can get, actually realize the full mercy of the Lord, but it's promised to him. So therefore, the Tattenu Kampang, you familiar with Krishna? Susamikshamana, Bunjain Evatmakutam Vipaka. So the mature second class devotee is patiently expecting the Lord's mercy. It will come when the time is right. Therefore, in the meanwhile, he tolerates Bunjana, enjoying suffering, however you want to translate the word. That's how you feel. Yeah. Whether you consider it enjoying your suffering, it tolerantly accept experience. What you know, actually, you've created for yourself. It's your own karma, anyway, that you're suffering and enjoying. It's not God's fault, it's our fault, whatever is happening to us now. Yeah. So, it's my karma, I'm just getting the results of my past karma. I'll tolerate it. I won't if it's what we call pleasurable. You know, if I am given a cool bath in the summer, I consider it pleasurable. The same water, the same temperature in the middle of the winter, I consider painful. And it's relative, according to my attitude and my circumstance. The same thing, I consider pleasure or pain, depending upon my attitude and circumstance. Anyway, just tolerate whatever it is. Pleasurable or unpleasurable, because it's our own karma. Vidvam vapur bir vidaram namaste. And meanwhile, offering respects, homage to the Supreme Lord, obeisances with one's heart, one's words, and one's physical activities. Jivete yo mukti padesh chadayava. One who just simply goes on living like that, not necessarily doing anything spectacular, world-shattering, but just going on with his life, being patient, tolerating that whatever is happening to him is his own fault, and constantly remaining a surrendered devotee, no matter what, then he is the legal inheritor to his father's property. He is promised and guaranteed all the benefits of pure devotional service whenever Krishna is satisfied that he's ready for it. That's the definition. That's the way that a middle class devotee should think and behave. Yes.
So we can say that the devotee realizes the situation of the world in the sense that
A mature devotee should be happy. He should be happy even if he gets some trouble, some physical pain or even mental pain. He should say, "That is wonderful. I'm getting my last nonsense burned out of me." But that's a mature. You could divide the phase of middle class devotee into, you know, lower and upper. So the upper class, the more advanced middle class devotee, he's happy to tolerate. And the lower class middle class devotee, he's still struggling with it. He's unhappy. You know, he hasn't matured enough to fully realize that what's happening to him is a cause for rejoicing. That, look, we're approaching perfection. It's just a little more suffering. We'll be done with it. Yes?
Unfortunately, the ending is quite
diminished. Yes, yes. Oh, yeah. And he'll understand it. But still, if he's just come into the
middle class platform from the Kanishka platform and he's still a bit immature, then his mind will rebel sometimes. You know, even though we know philosophically, you know, that yes, you know, everything that's happening is good for our own good, but still we get annoyed by little things, by silly little things. We get annoyed all the time. That's just a sign of our lack of maturity. To the degree that we become fixed up and our understanding becomes more full, then we put that aside. Okay. Final place here. Okay, so that's okay. Then verse 35. I'll just read that verse also. There's no comments on it. But then after departure of the Lord, the worshipful. Oh, I just read that already. Okay, he sat by Bindusarovara waiting. He just has 2 days to wait. Then verse 36. Manu syananamastaya shaka kaumba paricharam arupya swam duhitaram sabarya payatam mahim. Now the kshatriya is coming out to the stage. Swayambhuvanu. Kardama was sitting in his ashram meditating. Not much to describe. We don't hear. We just said, okay, he meditated for 10,000 years, and we don't even care what happened. You know, he's thinking about something in his head. There's not much to describe. But here's the kshatriya, Swayambhuvanu. Swayambhuvanu, with his wife, mounted his chariot, which was decorated with golden ornaments. Placing his daughter on it with them, he began traveling all over the earth. So here's a much more vivid picture, a spectacle. Here's the king of the earth on his great chariot, gold covered with gold, and he's going with his wife and daughter. Now the first purpose of the king to go out on his chariot is to see that everything's okay all around the world, and to catch any discrepancies and deal with them. He's making a tour, but because he has another agenda, he's bringing his wife and daughter with him because he has to get his daughter married. That's his duty. Not just the king, but anybody who has a daughter. If he doesn't properly arrange for her marriage, then that's a very great discrepancy, a very serious sin. So, okay, then next verse describes what happens. Tasmin sudanvan ahani bhagavan yat samadishat upayad ashramapadam mudik shanta vratasya tat. O Vidura, they reached the hermitage of the sage, who had just completed his vows of austerity on the very day foretold by the Lord. So actually, Kardama's 10,000-year vow was not exactly complete. Vishnu appeared a little bit early, so he still had 2 days of meditating to do anyway. And he finished everything he had to do in his meditating exactly on that day that Manu appeared, and it was the day that Vishnu predicted, 2 days in the future. Okay, and then verse 38 and 39. You take this one.
Yasmin bhagavato nitran yatatan ashrubindalaha kripaya samri tasya tatane pitaya visham tatvai bindu saro nama Saraswatya Pariplutam Punyam Shivam Vitajalam Maharshi Gana Sevitam.
The holy lake Bindusarovara, flooded by the waters of the river Saraswati, was resorted to by hosts of eminent sages. Its holy water was not only auspicious, but as sweet as nectar. It was called Bindusarovara because drops of tears had fallen there from the eyes of the Lord, who was overwhelmed by extreme compassion for the sage
who had sought his protection. This is a very sacred place where Kardama was doing his meditation. He got the name Bindusarovara after the appearance of Lord Vishnu there. It's described in the purport, described in the verse here, that this is where Lord Vishnu's tears fell. And Prabhupada explains in the purport that when Vishnu saw how much trouble Kardama had taken to meditate, just to get his favor, Lord Vishnu was feeling great compassion for Kardama, and therefore he was crying. Or alternate explanation, Prabhupada gives another explanation. No, of course, stop that. Stop it. Is that Vishnu was very happy to see the success of his devotee, and he was crying out of pleasure. Anyway, either way. Then there's a few verses describing the auspicious beauty of the place. I can read them real quickly. I'll just read the English, the next few verses. Verses 40 to 44. Just characterizing how auspicious and attractive a place this was, Bindusarovara. The shore of the lake was surrounded by clusters of pious trees and creepers, rich in fruits and flowers of all seasons, that afforded shelter to pious animals and birds, which uttered various cries. It was adorned by the beauty of groves of forest trees. The area was surrounded with the notes of overjoyed birds. Intoxicated bees wandered there, intoxicated peacocks proudly danced, and merry cuckoos called one another. Lake Bindusarovara was adorned by flowering trees such as Kadamba, Champaka, Ashoka, Karanja, Bakula, Asana, Kunda, Mandara, Kutaja, and young mango trees. The air was filled with the pleasing notes of Karandava ducks, plovers, swans, ospreys, waterfowl, cranes, chakravakas, and chakuras. The Prabhupada apologizes in the purport that most of these names of the birds and the trees can't be translated. And I have experience trying to look these up in dictionaries, that there aren't many English equivalents of these words. And it's not that these are unusual species, it's just that India has different species of birds that, you know, that don't occur in other parts of the world. And then verse 44. Chatayava harinai, I'll read English. It shores abounded with deer, boars, porcupines, gavayas, that's wild cows, elephants, baboons, lions, monkeys, mongooses, and musk deer. Okay. After that description of the beauty, then verse 45 through 47. Kavishya taptirtavaram arirajat sahatmajaha tadasya munivasinam tasmin huta hushtashanam vidyotamanam vapusha tapasyugra yujachiram Natikshramam Bhagavata Snigdapangavalokanat Tadhyaritam Vitakala Piyusha Shravanenacha Pramshum Padma Palakshaksham Jatilam Chiravasasam Upasam Shritya Malinam Yatahanam Asamskritam. Entering that most sacred spot with his daughter and going near the sage, saw the sage sitting in his hermitage, having just propitiated the sacred fires by pouring oblations into it. His body shone most brilliantly. Though he had engaged in austere penance for a long time, he was not emaciated. For the Lord had cast his affectionate sidelong glance upon him, and he had also heard the nectar flowing from the moon-like mouth, the nectar flowing from the moon-like words of the Lord. The sage was tall. His eyes were large, like the petals of a lotus, and he had matted locks on his head. He was clad in rags. Swayambhuva Manu approached and saw him to be somewhat soiled, like an unpolished gem. So he's trying to get his daughter married, and she's a princess of the earth. You don't expect that he's going to give his daughter away to some dirty beggar. And Kardama externally looks a little bit like that. You know, he's not dressed up to meet a king or his daughter. He's been meditating and performing sacrifices, smoke all over the place, probably ghee spilled on him. It's described that he's like a gem that's an unpolished gem. Prabhupada explains that when you dig very valuable jewels out of the earth, they're at first they're just rough stones. They may be covered with a crust or just, you know, not a very attractive shape, not very effulgent. They have to be cut and polished, and then they show their brilliance. So he's unpolished. He's not really presentable for the public, Kardama Muni. But the king, Manu, Swayambhuva Manu, can appreciate his qualities anyway. He has the intelligence to see through the surface. Actually, Kardama is described in the verse as looking very effulgent after having offered oblations in the fire. Not because of some physical effect. Physically, he probably looks covered with soot. But having performed spiritual activity, a person naturally begins to look effulgent. It comes from the spiritual strength and the favor of the Lord. The Lord is pleased, then a person takes on an effulgent look. And still, even though he had done austerities, severe austerities for so long, he didn't look emaciated. We don't know what real austerities are like. For us, to fast for 6 hours is a great austerity. But traditionally, what yogis did was very torturous to the body. And a person would look like he had been through a lot, very, very severe self-punishment. You could see when someone had performed severe austerities. Even 500 years ago, there is the story of Jiva Goswami. When he had first come to live with his uncles, Rupa and Sanatan, in Vrindavan, he was still a young man from, you know, just from his education in Benares, expertly trained up in Vedanta and all philosophies. So not that he was proud, but the occasion happened that this Digvijayi came trying to defeat everybody, came to Vraja, and he was told that Rupa Goswami is the most learned person here, if you can defeat him, then your reputation is assured. So the Digvijayi approached Rupa Goswami, asked for a debate, and Rupa Goswami wasn't interested. He said, just give me this Jayapatra, you know, certificate. You've won the debate. Give it to me. I'll sign it. I don't want to waste my time debating. So Rupa Goswami acknowledged defeat without even a debate. Signed the paper. But his nephew Jiva Goswami saw this and he became angry. And when he met outside the presence of his uncle, when he met this pundit, he told him, "Look, you want a debate? I'll give you a debate." And he argued with the scholar and defeated him soundly. Some say that was Vallabhavata, Vallabhacharya. Others say no, it was somebody else. Anyway, Rupa Goswami found out that Jiva Goswami had debated and defeated this pundit, and he was dissatisfied with Jiva. He said, "You're so proud of yourself. I think better you go leave Vrindavan and go west." So Jiva Goswami took that as punishment that he had been exiled by his Shiksha Guru. And so he left Vrindavan. He didn't go very far. He crossed the Jamuna to the other side. And he hid in a crocodile hole Bilvavan, or just on the shore of the Jamuna, across from Keshagata. Here from Shibata, or a little bit further down. And he stayed there for several months. So when finally, it was, Sanatan Goswami reminded Rupa Goswami, that he should be compassionate to all the jivas. He reminded him that Jiva Goswami is sitting there in exile, and they went to look for him. Nobody knew exactly where he was, and they heard about some yogi sitting in this hole, in Bilvavan. And when they saw him, they couldn't recognize him. I don't know who it was, but some devotee went to find him. Couldn't recognize Jiva Goswami. He was so emaciated. Probably on the verge of death, that they couldn't even recognize him. So that's what it's like when someone's performed austerity, even for a few months, real austerities, and even 500 years ago, let's speak of millions of years ago, it shows the person practically becomes unrecognizable. But Kardama, I says he wasn't even emaciated. And why? Because he had met Lord Vishnu, and he got the Lord's affectionate sidelong glance, and his ears were filled with the nectar of the Lord's words, and that kept his body stout and healthy. He's very tall. He has lotus eyes, large lotus eyes, signs of a great person, these beautiful signs. Still, he had matted locks, dirty hair, dirty, sticky hair. And he's dressed in rags, dirty rags. Anyway, this is a Brahmin. A king is always concerned to make an opulent show. He has to look gorgeous and act gorgeous. Brahmin doesn't care so much for external appearances. If, Brahmin wants to have influence in the world, but he doesn't have to put on a show. He doesn't depend on charisma and popular opinion. A Brahmin wants to have influence, that his word is taken seriously. And whether he gets the prize for the most beautiful dress, the nicest dresser in the kingdom, that doesn't matter. Or whether he's the most popular with everybody. Okay, any comments, questions? Yeah. You mean if a kshatriya is supposed to be a devotee also? Well, if a devotee is a kshatriya, then yes, he has to act proudly. He has to, maintain a reputation. That's his responsibility. He has to be respected and even feared by the citizens. So if he doesn't keep a good reputation, a good profile, then he's not doing his job. So therefore, he has to act proud. Just like a preacher. You can't just humbly give in to everything everybody says. You have to fight back if you're preaching. You have to, make a bold stand. That's not really proud, but you have to act proud sometimes. The Prabhupada says, a lion in the chase and a deer at home, like that. Inside, you're humble. But to do your duty, you sometimes have to act very boldly. So a pure Vaishnava king has to act like a king, which means to maintain a reputation. To be respected by the good citizens and feared by the bad citizens. You can't be negligent of that the way the Brahmin might be. But Kardama is he's acting like a Brahmin, not like a Kshatriya. Actually, these two people, Manu and Kardama, they're very similar. They're on similar levels of Krishna consciousness. They just happen to be performing different roles. They have somewhat different natures, but the difference is not that great. But once they've accepted their roles, they play them properly. Brahman has a certain way he's supposed to behave, and Kshatriya has a different way. And you'll see, Manu is now going to approach Kardama. First, Kardama will talk to Manu, and then in the next chapter, beginning of the next chapter, Manu will talk to Kardama. And what they say to each other is very important to pay attention to. What kind of attitude these two opposite, you know, members of the society, the Brahman and Kshatriya, what they think of each other and what and themselves in relationship. In relationship. What a Brahman is in human society is very much what he is in relationship to the Kshatriya. And what a Kshatriya especially is nothing if he doesn't have a proper relationship with the Brahmins. Brahmins can live without the Kshatriyas, but Kshatriyas cannot live without the Brahmins. And if the Brahmins want to live without Kshatriyas, they have to go to the forest or the Himalayas. If they want to live with the rest of the people in ordinary society, they need the protection of the Kshatriyas. So it's very important what the relationship is between these two classes. And that mutual symbiotic relationship is what keeps the whole human society in proper order. And that's what we're missing in the modern world. Okay, we'll look at verse 48.
Atsuta janmupayatam nidevam panatam puraha sataya karyagrihinat pratidanya nuruptaya.
Seeing that the monarch had come to his privatage and was bowing before him, the sage greeted him with benediction and received him with due honor. So this is interesting. The king has to acknowledge that the Brahman is superior. So the first thing the king has to do is bow down to the Brahman, not the other way around. King may be above everybody else, and everybody bows down to the king, but not to the Kshatriya. The king does not bow down to the... Rather, the Brahmins don't bow down to the king. The king bows down to the Brahmins. Now that having been done, then the Brahmin is free to show proper respect to the king. Because although the Brahmin is basically superior to the king, still he wants to acknowledge the king's position, the king's honorable position. So he first of all gives him his blessings. The Brahmin giving blessings is not just, you know, a sentimental show. It's not just some formality. This is really where the king gains his success from, or anybody. When you get the blessings of the Brahmins, then your life is successful. Brahman is the teacher. When your teacher is satisfied with you, then he signs your report card, you know, A+. When you get, you know, your parents receive the report card that you've got first class, you know, top grades, then your education is complete. When the Brahmins, in other words, when the Brahmins give you their blessings, then the Supreme Lord is satisfied. Then, by the blessings of the Brahmins, all intelligence comes to you, all prosperity. That's the real basis of human society. Success doesn't come from amassing a fortune of money or great military strength. It comes from pleasing the Brahmins, who are the representatives of the Supreme Lord. When they're satisfied, then Krishna's satisfied. Of course, what satisfies the Brahmins? Real Brahmins are not satisfied by bribes, by bhakshis, by charity, you know, money in their pocket, cross my palm with silver and I'll give you a blessing. The proper Brahmins are satisfied when they're able to impart the Vedic knowledge and people hear and accept it. When they can give the instructions of the Supreme Lord as they understand them, and people hear, and people put it, you know, into action in their lives, then the Brahmins are satisfied and give their blessings. You know, my dear boy, you've heard the instructions nicely. You're a sincere student, therefore I give you my blessings. The
modern Hindu society is completely misunderstood. Yeah. They think the sadhus are blessing machines. Touch their feet, throw some coins at them, and you'll get some blessings on your head, and you know, you'll get all sorts of benefits. Yeah, it's a good business deal. So there's a story that I don't, so-called, you know, hearsay. I don't know what, I can't cite the Shastra that it's written in. But Prabhupada was traveling on a train somewhere in South India with Tamal Krishnamaraj and some other sannyasi. And there were some young students, Southern Indian students, who wanted to get Prabhupada's audience. So they were sticking their head in the bogey, trying to get in, or trying to get Prabhupada's attention. They knew if Prabhupada saw them and acknowledged them, then he'd invite them in. So Tamal Krishnamaraj was shooing them away, trying to keep them away from the door, not to let Prabhupada see them. Finally, they got Prabhupada's attention, and he invited them in to the car. And he said, "What can I do for you?" And he said, "Oh, Swamiji, we just want your blessings." So Prabhupada very quickly, you know, got to the point and said, "You know, look at these disciples, Tamal Krishnamaraj, the other devotee there." He said, "This is my blessings. You become like them. You shave your head, become disciples." Anyway, that got rid of them very quickly. And they said, "Okay, thank you, Swamiji," and they ran away. That's blessings of the Guru. Blessings of the Brahmins. You know, to take their instructions. And that's what, they give blessings when they're satisfied, and the pure Brahmins feel they've done their work when someone hears them, hears their instructions, and accepts it. Then they're satisfied to give their blessings. Not, you know, the kind of blessings you can buy for 10 rupees. So that's what's happening here. Manu approaches, offers his obeisances, and even without a word being said, Kardama appreciates very much the attitude. Here is the king of the earth, and I'm just some, you know, beggar in rags sitting here in my ashram. He's bowing down to me. Oh, very nice. I offer you whatever blessings I have to give, I offer them to you. And then, this is the king. I'm also a citizen. I may be a Brahmin, but still, I have to offer the, I don't, you know, bow down to him, but I offer him a seat. I offer him some water. Whatever facility I have for hospitality in my humble ashram, I have to offer it to the king and acknowledge, oh, yes. You know, it's a great privilege to have you here as our guest. So that's what he does third. But the third thing that happens is that he receives him with due honor according to his means, according to his capacity. The Brahmin is superior to the Kshatriya, but still the king deserves due honor also, always. So that's described again in the Shatapatha Brahmana, again the sixth chapter, which describes actually the Rajasuya sacrifice. So in the Rajasuya sacrifice, there's a statement. Well, the context is it's describing how the Brahmin in the Rajasuya sacrifice has to worship the king. And he sits on a lower seat for that particular worship. Usually Brahman sits on a higher seat. But, you know, when it's time to worship the king in the sacrifice, then the Brahman sits on a lower seat. The statement is, Kshatrat param nasti tasmad brahmanakshatriyam adastat upaste rajasuye. No one is greater than the Kshatriya. Thus in the Rajasuya sacrifice, the Brahman worships the Kshatriya from a lower seat. Another statement in the same chapter, the Shatapatha Brahmana. Kshatriyam Pratamam Yantam Itare Trayo Varna Paschat Anuyanti. Also in the same sacrifice, when the procession is a procession, the king goes first, and all the other three Varnas, including the Brahmins, follow behind him. So the king, in situations he gets the proper honor. Why is that? The philosophical understanding is, let the kings take all the worldly honor. Let them get the respect of the people. Let them take all the wealth. let them enjoy all the opulence and the sense gratification. Brahmins aren't interested in that anyway, real Brahmins. So the king can have all the respect of the citizens. He can be worshipped and given everything. The Brahmins, they want to be honored, they want to be influential, and they want their influence to be acknowledged. But the form it takes is not in their being worshipped or showered with sense gratification. Brahmins don't want that. They simply want that the words that they're speaking be listened to. That's all. When everybody else listens to what they have to say, then the Brahmins are satisfied. They feel that they've been honored. Real Brahmin. The proper attitude of Brahmin. So the king, he can, you know, march first in the parade. He can sit on a big throne. Brahmins aren't interested in that anyway. Okay, any comments? Okay. Verse 49. Of course, these are the ideals. Now, this is the way, you know, in the real world, we find all sorts of corrupt Brahmins and Kshatriyas, but proper Brahmin, proper Kshatriya, this is the way they're supposed to be. No? Okay, text 49.
Grihit Vahanavasinam Samyatam Prinayan Munihi Smaran Bhagavadadesham Ityaha Shlakshnaya Gira.
After receiving the sage's attention, the king sat down and was silent. Recalling the instructions of the Lord, Kardama then spoke to the king as follows, delighting him with his sweet accents. Okay, so the king at first, he bowed down, he didn't say anything. Yeah. The Brahmin is the guru. So coming, the king approaching him, the Brahmin has to take the position of a disciple. You know, his business is first to listen. He can respond, but first he remain quiet and listen. So he didn't speak first. Although he's the one coming to Kardama with some business. Kardama didn't approach him. He's approaching Kardama. Still, he didn't say anything at first. That's proper. First, let me receive some instruction. Let me see what this Brahmin has to say. Then I'll address my business after he talks first. And then Kardama, he didn't just open up his mouth without thinking either. First, he thought carefully and remembered the Lord's instructions. Before speaking, a Brahmin, before doing anything, a Brahmin thinks first. What is Tasmat Shastram Pramanam Te Karya Karya Vivastitam? You may not have talked to God 2 days before. You may not have direct personal instructions. But the Brahmins always have the instructions of God in the form of the Shastra. And Krishna says at the end of the 17th chapter, 16th chapter, Tasmat Shastram Pramanam Te. You should always consider the scripture, your authority in all matters, all questions of what to do and what not to do. Don't just act on impulse. Don't trust your own intelligence. Always think before you do or say anything. What does the scripture say about this? That's how a Brahmin behaves. You know, he's careful before he says or does anything. He always makes sure that it's in line with the injunctions of scripture. Or in the case of Kardama, he has direct personal instructions of the Supreme Lord. So before, although it's the cue, he's given the cue. Okay, he's supposed to speak first. The king isn't saying anything. But before he speaks, he also remembers, okay, what was it that Vishnu told me? And then he addresses Manu with sweet words, trying to please him. A noble person, Brahmin or Kshatriya, tries to please everybody he deals with. It is important. It's not just politics or flattery or trying to keep people out of your way by being nice to them. But the superior person should be kind to the inferior people. These other people are suffering in confusion and material attachment. We should, you know, they're like children. So in dealing with children, you shouldn't be unnecessarily harsh with them. They're just children. They don't know. So therefore it's natural. The noble, superior person should be kind in his dealings with everybody. So therefore, Kardama
is addressing Manu, out of respect also, very politely. Okay, so now we're up to verse 50. Karnama now addresses Manu. Here's how a Brahmin should deal with a Kshatriya.
Nunam Chankramanam Deva Satam Samrakshanayate Vadaya Cha Satam Yastam Harik Shakti Ipalini.
The tour you have undertaken, O Lord, is surely intended to protect the virtuous and kill the demons, since you embody the protecting energy of Shri Hari. First thought is that you are representative of God. The king is the representative of Lord Vishnu, especially representative of the personification of the protecting potency of Lord Vishnu. Just like Krishna appears in this world to protect the devotees and kill the demons, he's saying the same thing about the king here. You're on tour, you're sitting on your chariot. First thought is, you're out here to protect the virtuous and to kill the demons, just like Krishna himself. Therefore, the Brahman is thinking of the Kshatriya as empowered, like a vibhuti, opulent expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Okay, first, any comments on that? First qualification, or the first important function of the Kshatriya, is to protect. The Kshatriya has to protect the citizens. He uses force, he takes taxes, so he takes power in his hands, he takes money in his hands, wealth in his hands, but it's for the purpose of protecting the citizens. If he fails to protect the citizens, that the criminals are not allowed to do nonsense, but also to see that principles, everybody does their varnashram duty properly. If he fails to provide that protection, then he has no right to take any taxes, he has no right to have his position. He's a nonsense and he'll go to hell. That's stated very, very emphatically in the Dharma Shastras, in the Manusam Samhita. The king who accepts 1/6 of everybody's income as tax, if he does his duty, if he gives protection, then he gets 1/6 of everybody's pious credits. But if he doesn't provide perfect protection, if he doesn't punish the evildoers, then he gets 1/6 of everybody's sinful reactions. And that will drag him to hell, surely. Especially if he fails to do his duty, the kingdom will be unruly, and there will be plenty of sinful reactions, and he gets 1/6 of all of them. He'll spend a long time in hell. Okay. Anything? Text 51.
Yakendragnindravayunam yamadharma prachetasam rupani stana adatse tasmai shuklaya te namaha.
You assume what necessary, the part of the sun god, the moon god, Agni, the god of fire, Indra, the lord of paradise, Vayu, the wind god, Yama, the god of punishment, Dharma, the god of piety, and Varuna, the god presiding over the waters. All obeisances to you, who are none other than Lord Vishnu. So we have a sort of bias in ISKCON, the demigods are nobody, useless. Actually, the demigods are glorified throughout the Vedas. The Vedas are all prayers addressed to demigods, not to Krishna. Krishna is mentioned very, once or twice in all the Vedas. But Indra is glorified constantly, and these other demigods that are mentioned here, they're all glorified in the Vedas. Because, the Acharyas explain, the commentators of the Vedas, the demigods are the representatives of the Supreme Lord. They're like the parts of his body, his specific energies. Indra is the ruling power of God. He represents the arm of the universal form. Indra comes from the arm of the universal form. And each of the demigods represent different powers of God. So, and it's even explained, I don't remember what the statement is, Krishna says that in the beginning of creation, I give my own forms and names and functions to the demigods on loan. You know, the names of the demigods are really my names, their functions and even their appearances are really borrowed from me. So, when we're talking about the king embodying all the demigods, that means he's embodying the personal energies of the Supreme Lord. Each of these demigods, Surya, Agni, Indra, Vayu, Yama, they're all different partial aspects of the Supreme Personality, especially the aspects that create and rule the universe. And then he says at the very end, Tasmai Shuklayate Namaha. Thus, since you are all the embodiments, all these demigods are embodied in you, the king, therefore you're actually Vishnu. Sum total of the demigod, that means Vishnu, the Supreme Person. Shukla, the all auspicious transcendental Lord. Okay. Then the next three verses together, 52 and 54, he describes in more detail the function of the king, especially in respect to maintaining the principles of religion. First, he mentioned in the beginning, you come and you protect this pious and you kill the demons. Well, the third function of God in descending to this world is to maintain the principle or reestablish the principles of religion. And the king also, as representative of the Supreme Lord, does that also. So that's described here, the maintaining of religious principles.
Na yada ratamastaya jaitam manigana arpitam vispuja chandako dandu ratena trasayan aghan swasainya charana kshunnam vetayad mandalam buvahat Vikarshan Vihatim Senam Paryatasyam Shumaniva Tadaiva Setavak Sarve Varnashrama Nibandanaha Bhagavad Vachita Rajan Vidyuran Vatatasyubihi.
If you did not mount your victorious, jeweled chariot, whose mere presence threatens culprits, if you did not produce fierce sounds by the twanging of your bow, and if you did not roam about the world like the brilliant sun, leading a huge army whose trampling feet causes the globe of the earth to tremble, then all the moral laws governing the varnas and ashrams created by the Lord himself would be broken by the rogues and thieves and rascals. So Karnava, he's a simple Brahmin sage. He's not interested in joining any armies that are trampling the earth or riding on a chariot. It's no personal interest to him. But he's very interested. The king who is taking the trouble to do all this, to lead armies and ride on his chariot to victory, he's protecting the principles of religion. He's protecting the citizens from the bad influences of rogues and rascals. All the moral laws of the varnas and ashrams that were created by the Lord himself would be broken if you didn't lead your army to victory, if you didn't use violence when necessary to punish those who refuse to obey those principles of varna and ashram. And then he says in the next verse, since we're out of time, I'll just read the next verse. I'll just read the English. If you gave up all thought of the world's situation, unrighteousness would flourish, for men who hanker only after money would be unopposed. Such miscreants would attack, and the world would punish. And the world would perish. So. And then last verse. In spite of all this, I ask you, O valiant king, the purpose for which you have come here, whatever it may be, you shall carry it out without reservation. So greedy men would be unopposed if the king didn't maintain a strong position, maintain his reputation, and at least always have the threat of punishment for anyone who did nonsense. Maybe he doesn't have to use violence, but at least he has to always be, threatening to use violence. Still, he's wondering, okay, fine, you're doing your job, very nice, but what did you come here for? What business do you have in my little ashram? So then he asks, okay, but you must have some special purpose for coming to me. Whatever it is, I'll be glad to do whatever you ask me. Charitable attitude. Maybe he's going to ask him to join his army and become prime minister or something. He offers, whatever you want me to do. If you're the king, I'm your humble servant. Just ask me what you want. Yeah, I'm done with it. Yes, bro. Maybe not. We're not told, but that he was told what's happening. We don't know. I mean, according to what we're told here, is just that Swayambhu Mahārāja got on his chariot, started wandering the earth, and he just happened to come to Bindusarovara. Maybe there's an untold part of the story. Yes? No, he intended to get it. I'm sorry, he intended to get his daughter married, but we're not told that he had any inkling that this is where he's going to find the right man. Yeah. Maybe there's a part of the story we're not told here. Somebody, maybe Lord Vishnu himself or somebody, maybe told him, but we don't know that. Yes, mother? A king shouldn't force a Brahmin into government service. He can invite him into government service. A king needs the guidance of the Brahmins. So, he wants to get good advisors. And sometimes, it's recommended by Madhu, if you can get a Brahmin to be a prime minister, that's the best person to do his job, a Brahmin. So sometimes the Brahmins were the prime ministers, or even the military advisors. But not, to force the Brahmin into government service is not proper. Yeah. Of course, we have like Nawab Hussain Shah, but he was a Mlecha, Yavana, and he forced Rupan Sanata into government service. But that's not, a Kshatriya shouldn't deal like that with Brahmins. You have to beg the Brahmins to please help us. We need help. Please help. Give us some advice. King has no power. Constitutional Kshatriya doesn't have the power to force the Brahmins to do anything. Yes?
Did you also hear, I heard that Rupan Sanata actually deliberately chose to take his position in the Nawabistan government because they were seeing how degraded the society was becoming.
Yes. That's interesting. I never heard that. There are different accounts of the life. There's not much record, hard facts to go by. So, but that's likely. Maybe that they wanted to get involved to do some good. I never heard that. Yes, just a minute. Anything else? Okay, thank you, Lord Rose, Srila Prabhupada.